Well, this hour we'll take your phone calls with Leonard Mlodinow as we talk about his latest work, Stephen Hawking, A Memoir of Friendship and Physics. And welcome back. We're back with Leonard Mlodinow as we talk about his latest book, Stephen Hawking, A Memoir of Friendship and Physics. And it was a deep friendship, Leonard, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And, you know, I really miss him.
I bet. I bet. Do you recall the last words that he uttered to you?
I don't. He was visiting Caltech, one of his last visits, because actually was his last visit here, because he got the last few years he was too ill to come to travel, and he could only speak about a word a minute then. So you'd say something to him, and you get an answer 10, 15 minutes later. It was really sad.
Wow.
But I remember I was visiting him, and Kip Thorne was there, and Buzz Aldrin, the astronaut, was there. And he was, you know, pretty good spirit. He would smile and look at you, but it was very hard to have a conversation at that point.
Was he tapped into, in terms of his knowledge, by physicists here in the United States, for example? Did people try to get information from him?
Oh, sure. Throughout his whole career, he was really, you know, not only a leader in doing research, but in guiding people, turning out students. He turned out a number of great students, and he was very influential, and people would come to him. That was one of the annoying things when I was working with him. I would be in Cambridge just to work with him. He was very nice about clearing his whole calendar so we could get a lot of work done, but yeah, people would come by and just stop at the office, and he would always talk to them. And they would have a question, or, you know, maybe it might have been something practical, like a financial issue for the department, or it might have been about a student or a question of physics. And they would say, oh, it's just going to be a minute, Leonard. You don't mind, do you, if we just come in for a minute? And a minute could be a half hour, an hour. I mean, sometimes it would just be like,
eh. Yeah.
But, you know, He was very generous with his time. He just, you know, and he, when we were writing the book, he acted like he had all the time in the world. You know, It's interesting because one would think that he was thinking that his time was limited, but you know, we discussed and debated every single word of the book, and if someone got exhausted from all this discussion, it was me and never him, even though he's the one who had to work so hard to say something, right? It was really amazing.
What did he think of black holes in the universe?
He thought they were probably amongst the most wonderful things, well, certainly amongst the most wonderful things in the world, if not the most wonderful thing. I mean, he
spent
decades studying black holes. Oh, yeah. I mean, they are. Come on, George. They're amazing. You can go near a black hole and come back to Earth and be 300 years ahead of time. You know, you can jump in time.
You won't be ripped apart?
You're giving us all those details. Okay, not that close. So you're right. That's a danger. I didn't know you knew that, George.
See, I study this stuff.
Yeah.
Let's take some calls. You ready? Let's go to Terry in Santa Barbara, California. First time caller. Hi, Terry. Go ahead.
Hi there. I'm glad to be able to tell you about this. But when I was teaching at Santa Monica College, the administration was really amazing, and we had something called a creativity seminar. We had four speakers that came and told us about their areas of study, and then we asked questions, and then we'd go to the faculty lounge and ask more questions. And just, he was one of them, but the others were Candace Pert, who discovered the presence of receptor cells in the brain, who were, the cells just sit there waiting for the particular chemical to come through. But anyway, John Lilly, who did dolphin research, Ricky Lee Jones, a really creative singer, and then Stephen Hawking. And it was so interesting. He was able to talk pretty well. It was in the 90s, the early 90s. He could talk with a computer. He had a computer voice.
Yeah.
And he had prepared a talk. And then when he came to the faculty lounge, he answered questions. And he just, like you said, he acted like there was just no end to the amount of time he would answer questions. It was so amazing. And some of the questions that came from the physics teachers, I taught math, and so I really wasn't able to ask him a lot of questions. And some of the other people asked wonderful questions. So I'm so much enjoying this. Did you know him at that time when it was in the 90s, like middle 90s, 94, 95?
No, I didn't. I met him in 2003. I had seen him in the late 70s. I was in the audience and saw him give a talk at Princeton, but I didn't know him personally till he contacted me, and then we got together. So I wish I had known him then, though, because he could do more, speak more quickly. But it's interesting. Another example of how generous he was, with his time, and a very giving person.
Did he have many friends, Leonard?
Well, he had some good. He had a number of really good friends. Robert Donovan, who's a chemist in England and Scotland, I guess now, and Kip Thorne, the famous Pasadena, Caltech Nobel Prize winner for gravity waves. And he had a few really close friends, and I think he was often lonely because Kip and Robert were not local for him, and unlike you and I, it's hard to meet people. It's because he communicated so slowly. It's hard to build a relationship. I mean, he and I built a relationship based on being thrown together for many hours for many days over years. But to meet someone casually and have it grow into a friendship really couldn't happen. So his best friends were ones from the old days when he could still walk, talk, and I think he had a lot of acquaintances, and he was close to some of his carers. He would go to their family events. He would lend them money when they needed it. He was very generous and close with them. But in terms of real friends, they were mainly the old friends he had from the old days.
All right, next up, let us go to Barry in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Welcome, Barry.
Hello, George. Always a pleasure, buddy. And I've got a great question about Stephen Hawking.
All right.
Let me say quickly, George, I told Tommy, last Friday night was absolute dynamite show.
Well, thank you.
No kidding. And please, you know what I told Tommy? Once a month, it'd be great if y'all would feature a band and start next time with ZZ Top and go from there. And once a month, when you and Tommy are doing those lines together, do a band.
All right. But go ahead, Bear. You're running out of time here.
No problem. I'm just curious. Do you think that Stephen Hawking, if he'd have had a normal build and a normal frame and, been able to live a normal type lifestyle, do you think he would have taken the mathematical route and become the genius that he was? Thanks for the call. We'll talk to you later, George.
Okay, Bear.
Hey, that was a great question.
You hit a nerve,
an important point, which is I don't think so, and I don't think he believed that either. We talked about that. When he started out, he wasn't very serious, and it wasn't until he was diagnosed with the illness that he said, I'm looking, I need a purpose in life. I want to do this physics stuff, and that really focused him. He was kind of a goof off, and that really put him on that path, and it helped also to keep away the distractions because we all have other things we might want to do other than physics, and physics is extremely hard and takes a lot of concentration, and you run into roadblocks, and you have to spend hour after hour and shut yourself away and isolate yourself in order to make progress. And it was easier in a way for him because his illness did that to him, and he thought that he always thought that his illness was a kind of superpower that helped him do that, set him on his path and allowed him to focus, and he took advantage of that. So I don't think he would have done what he did had he not had the illness.
And it's amazing that the illness did not affect his brain or his thinking.
It is, isn't it? But as you described it earlier, it's affects his motor neurons, and
yep.
The brain doesn't it's not moving around. So, but it's interesting. There's one story in the book about when he was at Caltech in the 70s, and he was in a wheelchair, and he his head hung funny, and he was very thin, and he looked funny, but his brain was fine. But he's walking down the wheel. Someone, they were pushing him down Colorado Boulevard, and somebody comes up and sees him and just assumes that he's, I guess, a beggar, just drops $10 in his lap or something. You know, and he was, you know, often underestimated in his early years, even by his university. I think they look at him, you know, he had a disability, and they thought he must be dumb, too. And they sure learned that wasn't true, right? But that's too bad that people are judged that way, isn't it?
It sure is. Let's go to West Hartford, Connecticut. Bill's with us. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Yes, hi, George. Hi, hi. Leonard, I'm an amateur astronomer myself, as well as a rational atheist. And my question to you involves religion and consciousness. Now, you said a few minutes ago that you had had a near-death experience, and you wrote a book a few years ago on consciousness, where one of the things you said, for example, in that book, was that what we know about consciousness now is approximately at the level of relating consciousness to electricity and magnetism before James Clerk Maxwell came out with his equations on electricity and magnetism. So we really don't understand yet what consciousness is. So my question to you is, even though I'm an atheist and I don't think there is such a thing as a literal heaven or a literal hell or a god or a devil or angels or anything like that, my point is, could it be that consciousness, because you did have an NDE, near-death experience, could exist once the brain and the body dies in an energy dimension or an energy universe that's not literally heaven or hell, but could be another realm, another dimension. Oh, I don't know whether to call it a dimension or a universe. You might understand better than me what to call it. Some kind of another realm that's not a religious heaven or religious hell. The mind, M-I-N-D, not soul, but the mind.
Well, many, many people believe that, and we certainly don't, as scientists, we don't have much of a grip. We don't have very little to say about consciousness. In fact, I was going to write a book on that and study it some years ago, and a friend at Caltech who was a neuroscientist convinced me not to because of what you said. He said, we can't even define it, really, scientifically, so it's too early. You know, scientists who study consciousness don't really study what you're talking about. They study very specific, concrete functions of the brain that they hope will help illuminate what consciousness is, like how your mind makes sense of the visual data that your eyes pick up. You know, that very concrete, specific questions about that, but not what is it? What's qualia? What does it mean to, you know, to feel love or, you know. And so I don't know. I mean, as a physicist, I would say, again, as Stephen would say, well, maybe, but, you know, I don't have any proof that that's not true, but I have no evidence that that is true. When we don't understand something, there's a tendency to read things into it, to come up with theories about it that maybe are a little bit jumping ahead beyond what we know at this point. And you can't say that they're true or false. It's just we're not nearly, you know, far enough along to say anything about it, and just have to accept that and wait for science to march along.
Did Stephen ever meet someone like Uri Geller, the mentalist?
Ooh, God, that kind of rings a bell, but I don't remember.
The Israeli?
I know who it is. I don't remember, though, George. Sorry.
That would have been an interesting meeting.
It would have been, yeah.
I would have enjoyed it.
Yeah, I would have liked to have him and Deepak talk to each other as well with regard to the consciousness issue, huh? But I never got them together either.
Let's go to Aliso Viejo, California. Dirk's with us. Welcome to the program. Hi, Dirk.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay.
My question was, Hawking appeared in the last Star Trek The Next Generation episode. In the beginning, he's playing cards with Data and Einstein and
Newton,
yeah.
That's because our friend Leonard wrote for Star Trek.
I did, but I didn't write that one. I know. Everyone thinks that. No.
You wrote him into the script or
something. Yeah. I did, but I didn't. I wasn't writing for them that season when that was done. But I also wrote for Star Trek The Next Generation. That's true.
But
maybe
he was in there.
To write with me.
That's interesting. How did he play his role?
Oh, well, he sat there.
He was in his wheelchair.
He was in his wheelchair. Yeah. They had the synthesizer could make him say whatever they wanted. So that wasn't hard. They rolled him in. I think he was visiting the lot, and telling them how much he liked the show. And one of the producers got the, I'll put you in. And so they did.
Did he have fun doing that?
He did. He had fun. He had a picture in his office, and he was proud of that.
I hope they paid him, too.
He was such a regular guy, right? He was, you think, big celebrity, brilliant guy, and disabled. He must be so different from the rest of us, but no.
That is, what a wretched disease, though, huh?
Yeah, it is.
Mike in Denver. Hey, Michael, go ahead.
Hey, good morning, George. Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Leonard, first of all, I just wanted to congratulate you on the new book. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because theoretical physicists don't always get the kind of attention that, say, an NBA basketball player would, but you definitely deserve it because I think you do some outstanding work. So thank you. I had a comment tonight on intelligent life. So, life is most likely to evolve in giant elliptical galaxies, whereas dwarf galaxies are thought to be the least hospitable, with the Milky Way falling somewhere in between. The idea that the universe might have more and less hospitable regions is speculative, especially since we have yet to find any instances of alien life. But habitable zones where water should be stable and Earth-like creatures have a fighting chance of surviving there. So my question is, what galaxies did Stephen find most likely to support intelligent life? And kind of what were some of the galaxies that you and Stephen talked about the most? Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mike, and thank you for the kind words. I think each galaxy is as you said, we have what people look for when they look for the possibility of intelligent life is generally life as we know it. So they say, is there a sun that's like our sun? Is there a region near that sun that has the right temperatures so that water would be a liquid, because we don't believe that life could, you know, develop with just solid water, otherwise called ice, and so forth. So we were looking for other suns and planets that are similar to our own, and in a way that may be a limitation of our imagination. But so as you're talking about the different kinds of galaxies, speculation, I would only want to call it knowledge about where, as you said, we don't really know, you know, about where life might be, is based on the assumption that it's very similar to the life here on Earth, which may or may not be true. Maybe we just don't have the imagination. So we didn't speculate about, you know, various different galaxies. We did talk, though, about the habitable zones, the so-called Goldilocks zone, where
a planet and its star, right?
A planet and a star, a planet so that the temperature is good for life, that there's water there, and so that we think that, you know, it might have a chance to develop. But we don't have to look beyond our galaxy. There are many, many stars in our own galaxy that are like our sun. There's many planets that are like that fit that are like the Earth. And so the question is, given an Earth-like, you know, a sun-like Earth and Earth situation, how often will life start? And that's the one thing we don't know. I mean, we know a lot about evolution. Once life has started, we know how a bacteria can evolve into a human. That's, you know, pretty well understood. But how does the first life on a planet begin? And since we don't know that, no one can honestly say that they can give you an honest scientific answer about how likely it is that there's other life in the universe. We scientists and other people tend to believe, I think, that there is life on other planets, because we think surely it's not, you know, that rare. But, you know, if it's 1 in 100, then there's going to be a lot of life. If it's 1 in a zillion, you know, a trillion or something, then we're the only ones.
Leonard, hold on for a sec. We're going to come back and take some final calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're going to come back in a moment with Leonard Mlodinow now and take some final phone calls. Next hour, we're talking about Edgar Allan Poe, so get ready for that. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you, Leonard Mlodinow with us, and we're talking about his latest book, Stephen Hawking, A Memoir of Friendship and Physics. Leonard, in your opinion, what was Stephen Hawking after? What did he try? What was the answers he was looking for?
He wanted to know a simple question, the answer to a simple question: what is the meaning of our existence?
Yeah, something we're all looking for.
We are, and, you know, he treated it from the physical point of view. And he want, you know, and he investigated not just us as people, but all our surroundings. Where did it all come from, and why is it like that, and what does it mean? Other people look at it spiritually, but he had a lot in common with them, and he was looking for his answers in his way, and other people look at it in different ways. That there's no conflict between that; it's just different approaches.
Did he ever get that answer in your mind?
I think he felt that he did. Yeah, with his work at the end, it's that theory of that really everything came out of nothing and
a brief history of time.
Yeah, or the grand design. Really, that's the title. The grand design was his idea, and he really meant it. It's somewhat double meaning in a way, but it's the grand design was his answer to that question. It was, this is design, if you believed in God, this would be God's design of,
sure,
of the universe, and that book laid that out, what he believed that was.
Did he leave open the possibility that there could have been a divine creator?
Well, he didn't rule it out. When the book first came out, the London Times had a headline that said, Stephen Hawking, God did not create the universe. And that got us a lot of publicity, but that's not what the book says.
No, it's not. I remember you on the show talking about that with us.
Yeah, you have a good memory. That's right. Yeah. So, and he was not saying that there's no God. He was just giving, his answer to that, to the question of how we got here, and from the physics point of view. But, as a physicist, you start from somewhere. You start from our idea of what is nothing and what are the laws of physics, what is quantum theory, and so God, who made that? That could be God, too, So he wasn't ruling out God. He was just staying in within the lines of his physics, but that was his answer, and he felt, I think, in his last 10 years of life, he had finally found that.
Did he have faith? I mean, he was beaten down in life physically, but did he have faith?
He had faith. He had a lot of faith. One is, in his work, he had faith that the laws that he believed in applied everywhere and that there weren't exceptions. But even in his own personal life, he took about 85 vitamins a day because his father was a physician. And when he was in his 20s and came down with his illness, his father thought that these vitamins would help him. And there never was any study or any, scientific evidence of them helping him. But he was so attached to them, he would freak out if he didn't have his vitamins. He was in Texas once.
He's like me. We'd get along on that one.
Maybe you would. But 85, George, that's a lot of them. But
I'm pretty darn close.
Oh, well, there you go. Well, he was in Texas once. And remember that Icelandic volcano with the name you can't pronounce?
Yes.
And that went off. And he got stuck there. He couldn't go back. I was actually with him. And he couldn't go back when he wanted it. And he was desperate to get his vitamins. He told his assistant Judith to try and get the now King of Spain to charter a jet to take him back or to bring him vitamins. And she thought that was, she said, like, get a life. We're not going to do that. But he was, he had faith, but he had such faith in that cure, or that was what was helping him live longer, that he was very upset when he's had to spend, I think, about a week without his vitamins.
He might have been right.
Who knows, right? That's the thing. You don't know. But this was something that he took on faith because he had no evidence for it. So, he's a complicated man.
Let's go to Joe in the Bronx. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Hey, George, how are you?
Okay, wonderful.
Good. Leonard, I wanted to ask you, since you were so close to Stephen Hawking, did he ever discuss dreams that he had?
Dreams? Did he have dreams, Leonard?
I'm sure he did, but we never talked about his dreams. His nights were, they would have been interrupted because he had tough nights.
Or nightmares, huh?
Or nightmare. Actually, I think he did have some nightmares. I don't think we discussed what they were, but I remember hearing about that he would have nightmares sometimes. But think about what he went through, because at night he's laying there and he's disconnected from his computer. He can't communicate and it's dark, so he can't even see if he's trying to do something with his face. And he'd have a carer who would always have to sit with him. But you know how you have to toss and turn or just turn sometimes
yep.
because you have an ache? He can't do that.
Oh,
and so he'd wake up in pain, and he'd have to wait for them to, you know, they would periodically come and check him or move him. But he might have to lay there for a half hour waiting for this. And, again, that would seem tortuous. But so, you know, I don't think he got really good sleep. I think it must have been interrupted a lot.
I don't think I could have done what he did to survive. I just don't know if I could have handled that.
I've thought the same thing, and I don't know. I hope that if I had that challenge, I would, you know, grow with it and adapt. But yeah, I don't know. He, you know, could very well be that you and I couldn't do that. I mean, he was a very special person.
Absolutely, he was. Walter in Pennsylvania. Hey, Walt, go ahead.
George, when you have guests of the statue of Dr. Leonard on, I have no problem staying awake, George.
Well, you should stay awake all the time, Walter. You know that.
Great conversation. George, you got eight months on me, George. I'll be 70 next year, so.
Well, happy birthday soon enough, huh? It'll be there.
Yeah, George. I mean,
no rush.
We're all getting there, George, sad to say. Well, I just want to say, you know, with our great scientists like Hawking, and we mentioned Einstein, I think we have to remember that underneath it all, they are very human. And they're. I've always, with Einstein, as I was telling Tom, you know, he in later in life, he seemed to have taken on like a P.T. Barnum showman, like a persona, and I think it was his hair. Because if you look at pictures of Einstein in 1905, when he actually concocted the theory of relativity, he had very neatly coiffed the haircut.
Sure, I mean it looked finely brushed and combed.
Yeah, it was. He was all slicked down, like you know the proverbial greasy kid stuff. But as he got more and more famous, it seemed to me like he purposely would. Even like it almost looked like he would have his hair teased, you know, and to make him look like a sort of like a walk and talk and Tesla coil, like he had an electromagnetic hair, you know what I mean? So
it's like my buddy Giorgio Tsoukalos from Ancient Aliens, same thing.
Well, my hair isn't that different either. I'll tell you, it's curly, and when it gets in the COVID times and I don't get the haircuts, I start looking like Einstein. I wish I would think like Einstein, but, you know, maybe some of it's also when you get older, you go, you know, I'm tired of, you know.
Was he eccentric, Leonard, Einstein?
Oh, yeah, he was.
I mean,
you know,
that could be why.
On the street and he was walking, he'd pick it up and smoke it because he liked to smoke and he wasn't supposed to smoke. And
he'd find a cigarette butt and smoke it?
Smoke a cigarette butt if he walked across. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
He didn't wear socks, which now is kind of, you know, in style, but back then it was pretty weird. And but I think he just felt he didn't feel tied by conventions. I think he was very, I mean, just like in his physics, Einstein's discoveries were things like special relativity. Any high school kid could have discovered that. It's high school math. But people believed in what they believed in, you know, the old physics and the conventional physics, and he thought unconventionally, and that allowed him to make that discovery. And that does when you have a mind like that, it's not restricted to art or physics. It your life is like that too. That's why a lot of the most creative artists, writers, scientists are very eccentric.
All righty, let's go to Joe in Long Island, New York. Hi, Joseph. Go ahead.
Hi, Leonard. I do wonder if the polio vaccine might have triggered something with Stephen, but my question would be, he supposedly dabbled in or was interested in ESP in college, and I wonder how you would actually be proactive about that. And also with the stars, they supposedly need to be magnitude 1 through 6, and if they're dimmer than that, you can't really pick them up. Is that true?
Well, you can with a telescope. Go ahead, Leonard.
You know, I remember something about Stephen and ESP in his early days, but I don't really remember the details.
Yeah, I don't recall anything about the extrasensory perception with him.
I think he was very young. It may have even been in high school that he got interested in it, and he convinced himself, I remember, that it wasn't true. He didn't believe in it, but he did some experiments or investigation, but I don't remember, you know, the details about exactly when he did it or what he did.
And what about the magnitude of stars with the naked eye?
I don't know what he meant by that. Obviously you see the brighter stars with your naked eye, and then you need a telescope.
To see them way out there.
Yeah. And, you know, and right, exactly. And even with our optical telescopes, it's just in the Milky Way, you need really fancy stuff to see stuff further away.
Let's go to Mike in Reno, Nevada. Hey, Michael, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Thanks, George. I understand Jeffrey Epstein held a number of high-level meetings with the top physicists in the world. This was covered about a year ago in the New York Times. It's a huge story. It's almost James Bond-like with Spectre and Dr. No. I wonder if your guest knows anything about this.
Oh, sure I do.
You do, really?
Oh, yeah. First of all, I was at one of those myself. He invited me along with Murray Gell-Mann, Nobel Prize winner.
Didn't know he was a whack job.
No, I didn't. And that's the point. You know, I didn't know that. And I guess it was pretty well covered up and hidden back then. And I know Stephen went not to the one I was at, but he was at one. And I think Epstein, from what I read, in hindsight, you know, he was trying to get credibility by, cavorting with scientists, or, you know, he would sponsor conferences. So to me, it's just, I'm invited to a conference.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Some of my friends are going. Murray Gell-Mann, the famous, you know, Nobel Prize winner, is going, yeah, I'll go to that too. And I'll speak there. And it was kind of like a TED conference, but just for Epstein.
Well, he had the money to do it.
He had the money to do it. And no one knew any, you know, no one knew what we were doing or what he was doing. So it's unfortunate, but he talked about how much he loved science, and but I don't know if he loved science or he just, you know, wanted to
have that
credibility
image
of scientists, you know, and most of us are pretty naive, and, you know, who studies, you get invited somewhere, you don't necessarily study the past of the person who's inviting you, and no one, you know, it wasn't real well known, I guess, back then, so that was that.
He was a strange guy. Unbelievable.
What a story. No, I mean, it was clear already that he was a strange guy. You know, but my wife went with me. It was a very normal-seeming conference, really. I've been invited by billionaires before to give talks, you know, to them and their friends, so it wasn't that unusual.
Well, when he was an investment banker, he put on a good show.
Yeah, he did. And I think people I don't think people on Wall Street were particularly suspicious of him. He was just another rich Wall Street guy to me. I don't know.
Austin in Arlington, Mass., welcome to the show. First-time caller. Hi, Austin.
Hi, George. Could I ask Dr. Leonard two questions?
Let's get him in as quickly as you can. Go ahead.
Okay. Since Stephen Hawking didn't believe in God, how did he get his great happiness? And the second question is, I would like Dr. Leonard's opinion on this. With all the billions of stars and the many galaxies and all the unanswered questions in the universe, how can one not believe in God?
That is always the great possibility, to be sure. How about the happiness? Was he a happy person, Leonard?
That's one of the amazing things about him, is that he was a very happy person, optimistic, energetic, had joy for life, despite, you know, his disability.
Good for him.
What he discovered, or I think what the ancient Stoics discovered, the Greeks, was that happiness, really true happiness, happiness that can't be destroyed, is happiness that comes from within, not from your situation in life, not from your wealth, your material goods, not even from other people. It's from being happy with yourself, you know, and he had that inner happiness, which was inspirational. I mean, that's why I wrote the book, because he was such an unusual person, and you can learn a lot from it.
And the call's right in terms of, how could you not look at this planet and say, this is so magnificent, it is so wondrous, there's just no way this was happening by random. There's just no way. Now, what put it together, and what is that higher intelligence? Really, that's up for debate, but it's got to be something, don't you think?
Well, to a scientist, we learn that when we don't know what that something is, we don't speculate. You know, we don't guess. We don't go there.
But you keep the window open, though, don't you?
Yeah, of course. You always keep the window. Yep. And everything that we know that I've been talking about today, George, might be completely wrong. You know, people in the end of the 1800s thought they knew everything about physics, too. And it all got turned out before quantum theory, before relativity. It all got turned upside down because we discovered new things which made us revise our theories.
Leonard, where do people get the book Stephen Hawking?
Anywhere. It's everywhere. It's in the bookstores. It's online, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, at your independent stores. It's everywhere.
Come back again, okay?
Thanks, I will. I always have fun with you, George.
Thanks. Leonard Mlodinow, no, he's just a great, decent human being. We need 100 million more like that. Up next, we're going to talk about Edgar Allan Poe and tarot cards.